I'm particularly sorry I was late. Fortunately, Andre could jump in. That was very kind of him. Okay. Nonlinear structure formation in modified gravity. This is work being done with Wayne and Alexi, who are here, and then Marcus Lima and Hiroshi Ryazu, who are former students in Chicago. So I think we've heard enough. A lot of motivation, I presume.
Can you mic? Yes. Can you mic
awakening? Okay, so I guess the liquor will keep.
Okay, so, right. So I'm not going to motivate modified gravity. I'm just going to begin with pointing out challenges. One is that, for example, Alberto talked in detail today, is that gravity is constrained on a wide range of scales, and it's hard to modify. So in particular for us, solar system constraints are important, which basically rule out that there is a large scalar contribution to gravity on solar system scales. And also the early universe, especially in form of the CMB, provides crucial constraints. And the idea is that you can avoid or evade these constraints by reducing to GR in a high curvature regime, because this applies both to the solar system and to the early universe, both regimes where the curvature scalar is quite large. Okay, so then observationally, of course, we want to distinguish modified gravity from competing scenarios, which is mainly GR plus dark energy. Now we have the problem that simply looking at the expansion history is usually not enough, because you can basically explain any W of Z with dark energy model. And so what we have to do is go beyond the background expansion history and look at the growth of structure. And here, in the models aisle, at least we're talking about, and that Wayne talked about in detail yesterday, I presume, is the predictions are straightforward to work out in the linear regime. The nonlinear regime, this is less so, and that's what I will be focusing on. So let's review how we would use large-scale structure to, or growth of structure to check gravity. There's the linear regime, where, as I said, perturbations are linear, and you can work things out for any given theory. So this concerns the CMB, supernovae, integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect, also BAO. The nice thing is there that that you can parametrize gravity. So one popular approach is this gamma parameter. You can do more general things that are more physically motivated, and Levon Pogosian has worked a lot on this with colleagues. However, there is limited statistical power on linear scales, especially nowadays, since you really have to go to very large scales in the low redshift universe. And nonlinear regime is actually very interesting, because you have a wealth of observables, galaxy clustering, weak lensing, cluster abundance, and lots of signal to noise. Unfortunately, there's no known way to parametrize gravity in general in the nonlinear regime. That's kind of an obvious statement. And in particular, we know that there has to be some kind of nonlinear mechanism, as pointed out earlier, to reduce gravity to GR in high curvature regions. And that will be important for this nonlinear structure. So what we have to do, specialized n-body simulations for any scenario, for any given model. Right. And so let me move on. So I'm going to talk. So these are the two main models that most people talk about when they talk concretely about modified gravity: the DGP brain world model, where gravity leaks into a large extra dimension, a fifth dimension that Alberto talked about this morning as well in context. And then there's the FFR model, which is really just the phenomenological extension of GR, and is equivalent to a scalar tensor theory. Again, both of these use those certain nonlinear mechanisms to reduce the GR locally, which are very different in their character for these two models. So it's quite interesting to compare the two. And again, I presume Wayne has introduced these models in some detail yesterday. I will concentrate on the DGP model for this talk, but I'll be happy to answer any questions on the F of R as well, obviously, if I can. Right, so in the DGP model, the picture is that matter and radiation are confined to a four-dimensional brain, which sits in a five-dimensional asymptotically Minkowski space, and you construct the action in order to reduce to four-dimensional gravity on small scales, right? So, again, ordinary fields are confined to the brain. Gravity is five-dimensional, but only on large scales. Small scales, we know that it has to be four-dimensional. Right, and so there is a transition scale where above which gravity becomes five-dimensional. This is the crossover scale R sub C, and it's technically given by the ratio of the two gravitational constants in this model. So, interestingly, this model has two branches because there's two ways you can embed the brain in the asymptotically Minkowski space. One is the self-accelerating branch, which does lead to an accelerated expansion today if you adjust the crossover scale to be order H naught of the order of the horizon scale today, but it doesn't lead to lambda CDN. So we already, from the expansion history, we do have a constraint from CMB and supernovae and others that is in four sigma conflict. There's the normal branch. Oh, in addition, of course, to the theoretical problems of the self-accelerating branch, which probably rule it out by itself already. The normal branch, you don't get acceleration, but so you have to add some kind of lambda or dark energy on the brain. But it's still a modified gravity model that you can test. Right, so beyond the background, I will only be discussing sub-horizon scales here, and scales that are much smaller than the crossover scale. In that case, this brain is basically very close to its background position and only has small perturbations. Those perturbations, those displacements of the brain in the one extra dimension are quantified by this massless field, phi, that Alberto called pi this morning, the brain bending mode. So on sub-horizon scales, it's really quite simple. Phi contributes directly to the Newtonian potential. Sorry for the cutoff, but there's no more term here, so it's just these two. Right? And in the normal branch, phi is attractive, like a normal well-behaved scalar force. Self-accelerating branch, phi is repulsive due to the inverted kinetic term. So on linear scales, phi does is just a massless scalar field, and turns out that it is, and I mean, naturally is just proportional to the Newtonian potential, again, sub-horizon scales. And there's this cupping parameter which goes like HRC. So as you go to the early universe, H becomes very large, beta becomes large, and so the contribution of phi to structure formation becomes small. And in the end, so on linear scales, you just have an effective Newton constant in these models, which is just ordinary Newtonian gravity rescaled by 1 plus 1 over 3 beta. Now, the problem is that on nonlinear scales, this Weinstein mechanism, these nonlinear interactions become important that Alberto mentioned already. So the equation of motion is not simply a Poisson equation. Again, let me just skip ahead, point out that here, I will neglect time derivatives because on sub-horizon scales in cosmology, all motions are non-relativistic, and you can neglect time derivatives with respect to spatial derivatives. And then the equations look like this. Instead of just a Poisson equation for phi, like for the Newtonian potential, you get these complicated nonlinear terms, Laplace phi squared minus bi dj phi squared. This looks contrived, but Alberto did a lot of gave a lot of motivation for why these terms should look like this. In fact, we expect that those types of interactions are generic to brain world models because they have a geometric interpretation in these models. So this is, of course, a very hard equation to solve. especially in the cosmological context where you have a complicated nonlinear density field, because it's nonlinear in the derivatives, in the second derivatives of phi, and you don't have any superposition principle. So in general, this can only be solved numerically. But there are two interesting analytically solvable cases. One is a plane wave, just phi goes as e to the ikx, and then you see that the nonlinearity cancels. And that's related to the basically this generalized Gauss theorem that you have for the brain bending mode, and which actually saves you from the catastrophe that Nia Yesh mentioned, that what if the if you go to very small scales, the density field is extremely nonlinear, and what happens there? The nice thing is that as you go away from an isolated mass, the equipotential surfaces become more and more flat, more and more like a plane wave, and the nonlinearities progressively decay much faster than the field itself. So in the end, you recover the linear solution. And this is, you can solve this more explicitly with the spherically symmetric mass. If you write this equation in spherical coordinates and assume a spherical source, then you see that you obtain a unique analytical solution where this characteristic scale appears, the Weinstein scale, given by the cube root of Schwarzschild radius of the mass times R crossover scale squared. Now I have R star is 100 parsecs, so this is again, I think, a different number. The Weinstein radius for the sun, earlier we had 10 to 20 centimeters and one parsec, I don't know, it's somewhere in that ballpark. It's big. It's big. So just to show this solution, this plot shows the ratio of the force, gravitational force in DGP to just ordinary gravity. And let's consider these different colored lines correspond to different models. These two are normal branch. These two are self-accelerating branch. It's not so important. The main thing is focus, for example, on this blue line. The linear prediction is just, a flat scale-independent enhancement of gravitational force. If you take the actual solution, take into account the Weinstein mechanism, you see that as you go towards smaller scales, GR is restored. And what I assumed here is an NFW halo, so just generic dark matter halo. Sorry, it's the gravity,
the ratio of the gravitational force in DGP to GR for the same, for a given mass. So
one is GR. And self-accelerating branch forces are suppressed, so it approaches one from below, and in the normal branch also approaches one from above. And so this is actually independent of mass, it turns out. Another peculiarity of the Weinstein mechanism, if you phrase it in this way. So this is, the radius here is shown in units of R200 of the standard standard typical radius of the halo. And so you can see that, depending on the model, these nonlinear interactions are even important on quite large scales. So these could be massive halos. These could be several megaparsecs, up to 10 megaparsecs. So, this is, again, perfectly spherically symmetric. And in fact, of course, halos are not spherically symmetric. And the nonlinearities, you don't have an analytical solution for elliptical halos, for example. So what we have to do is really, we need a self-consistent solution, nonlinear phi field, and together with dark matter, and solve that in conjunction as part of an n-body simulation. So the work we've done is, and it's exactly in parallel to work done by Roman and his student, and to Mark Wyman here. It's really very essentially conceptually the same thing. The implementations are slightly different. So we use a particle mesh code. That means dark matter density as well as the gravitational potential are evaluated on a cubic grid. And the main task is to calculate the modified forces and then propagate the particles according to these modified forces. So the propagation of particles is completely unchanged. It's really just calculating the modified forces. And to do that, we first calculate the Newtonian potential, which is easy. It's a linear equation. You can do it by Fourier transform. And the main task is to calculate this phi given a nonlinear density field. So what we use is a relaxation, Newton-Raphson relaxation scheme, parallelized, shared memory parallelized with multi-grid acceleration, multi-grid method. Kind of a technical detail, but it's essential to achieve convergence because the nonlinear equation really makes makes the relaxation very slow compared to a linear equation. And then finally, once we've solved for the brain bending mode, we can assemble the total potential, as I showed earlier, as just the sum of the two, calculate the gradient of that, and that is our gravitational force.
What does it take to calculate the phi, basically, compared to calculate the psi?
Yeah, it's about 20 times slower.
Okay.
Yeah, it's significant. So you can forget about optimizing any part of your code except this part.
And it's actually, I mean, there's a number of things that needed to be done to actually get this to converge. I had to increase the number of particles to make the density field smoother, reduce the particle shot noise and the density field, et cetera. So it, yeah.
Of course, it's like spread out by the particles by the kernel, right?
Right, particles, yeah. So one particle is as big as a grid cell. But in addition, I have to solve, employ some smoothing on the grid scale, which, I lose a slight amount of resolution. It might not be technically necessary, but I was a little bit worried that the residual errors might be too big without the smoothing, so I used it.
What are the kernels?
It's a Gaussian with one grid cell or with 0.8 grid cells, 0.5, that range.
It's all in shared memory, you said, though? This, you know,
yes.
So you thought about, you know, porting the code to work in more distributed type?
Yes, that's actually...
What's the hard part here, I guess?
What's
the hard part, I guess, for the calculation?
What do you mean with hard?
I mean, well, like, what's the slowest part, I guess, in this calculation?
The slowest part is just the slow convergence. So in this case, each single relaxation step just... involves some algebraic, you know, operations, just elementary operations, no transcendental functions or anything. So it's really just that you have to do your relaxation many, many times. And of course, it's dominated by the finest grid level because you have most cells there. So probably would be most efficient, which is actually a work in progress, not by me, but by other groups, to try to include this into an adaptive, fully adaptive mesh code, because it's, of course, you gain by using a distributed memory architecture, but you also gain a lot by only refining in regions where you have to. So you can reduce the number. A lot of these grid cells are, of course, almost empty or completely uninteresting, and so it's very efficient to selectively refine on halos, on regions where you're interested.
It's also worth saying that one of the things that makes it technically hard to parallelize is the cross terms and derivatives. There's a dx dy, so dx phi dy phi comes in, so you can't break the grid in the usual way and say just x y z, so the relaxation depends on cross derivatives.
Right. Yeah. So there's a standard scheme of parallelizing such grid based algorithm, which is called red black, where you basically think of a checkerboard, and you... think of a chessboard, and you basically... the way it usually works is when you relax, black squares only depend on white squares, and vice versa. So you can do black square, if you know, if you have a previous guess on the white square, you can do the black squares in any order so you can parallelize it. And the problem is in DGP, these mixed derivatives break that. So I tried to put four different colors, so to speak. So not red, black, green, blue scheme, but anyway, those are details.
So when you are in this strong coupling regime, is that when this takes longer, or basically if you go to early times or in more dense regions, that's...
Yeah, it's one of the subtleties with DGP is actually the... So you're right, what really is important is the Weinstein scale for one particle as a unit of the grid scale. And it's typically on the order of the grid scale throughout the whole of Kusmov. It's just a property of the Weinstein mechanism that really only depends on the co-moving density. And the co-moving density of your particle just stays the same. So really, it's all at all times.
It's the same at all times.
Yes. Okay. F of R is different. Okay, so the models I simulated is first the best fit, even though it's a bad fit, but
the best fit self-accelerating DGP model without any lambda or dark energy. And also some normal branch models where I added in dark energy. And I added in dark energy in such a way to exactly cancel the DGP effect so that you get lambda CDM expansion history. And that basically allows you to adjust the crossover scale to whatever you want because there's no constraints from the expansion history on this. It's obviously a contrived model, but the nice thing is it's fully understood, at least on small scales. And so it's a consistent model. And it can also serve as an effective model for more generalized brain world models, cascading gravity, and such things that people here at Perimeter work a lot on. And in each case, I simulated a GR model with exactly the same expansion history and same initial conditions to really be able to compare with the least possible noise the modified gravity effects. And I also simulate a linearized DGP case. What I mean by that is a case where you completely neglect that nonlinear, those nonlinearities in phi, so really just the scale independent enhancement of gravitational constant for the normal branch. And the idea is that if you compare those two, you can really isolate the effect of the Weinstein mechanism from everything else. Okay, so here's a slice through a GR simulation, 64 megaparsecs on the side at redshift 0. You see, you know, the big voids, massive clusters at the center of, at the intersection of filaments, the usual picture. And now for DGP, normal branch with crossover scale 3,000 megaparsecs, so still quite big horizon scale.
Yeah, that's a whole simulation. So small spots. And you see it's basically the same thing, same initial conditions, but when you go back and forth,
you can see that in DGP things are slightly more evolved. For example, these two halos are closer to merging. Other halos have already merged. And there's, for example, here there's something popping out of into the, you know, that exists in the halo that didn't exist in GR. So basically, it's just slightly more evolved density field.
So this is 512 grid cells on the side.
And this plot, I hope you can see something here. The right plot shows the dynamical potential, which is mainly the Newtonian part. And you can see, you know, the deep potential wells where there's clusters, halos. And this is the brain bending mode. And I hope you can see that there is a clear difference between the two. The brain bending mode seems much fuzzier and more washed out. And this is precisely the effect of the Weinstein mechanism, which makes the field saturate rather than follow the potential, the potential into the potential well. So Oh, unfortunately, that's slightly cut off. So this is the first thing you would look at in these simulations, the power spectrum. So this plot shows the power spectrum in self-accelerating DGP relative to a dark energy model with exactly the same expansion history. And you can see the scale is negative because growth is suppressed in the self-accelerating branch. And the dotted line is the linear prediction, so you can see that on large scales we do indeed recover the linear prediction. So the worry that nonlinearities on small scales might propagate back to large scales is indeed not the case in DGP due to the branching mechanism. So the red is the the linearized simulation. The blue is the full simulation, and the difference between the two is clearly the Weinstein mechanism. Okay, so the Weinstein mechanism, as you expect, it suppresses the deviation from GR on small scales. So instead of the nonlinear matter power spectrum being more and more suppressed relative to GR, it turns around. This dashed line shows the halo fit, which is, it's a standard fitting formula to map linear power spectrum to nonlinear. So I can stick the DGP linear power spectrum into that. And you can see it matches, it does predict this kind of turnaround shape, which I will come to later. But, the amplitude doesn't quite match. Works quite well on, on mildly, very mildly nonlinear scales, though. And the same for the normal branch, again, with 3,000 megaparsec curvature crossover scale. Basically, the same. The whole thing flipped, right? This now growth is enhanced. Large scales, it's scale independent, and then as you go towards smaller scales, where the nonlinear effects become important, not only DGP but ordinary gravity as well, you see deviations from scale independence. So again, you see this characteristic turnaround, even in the linearized DGP simulations. So clearly, this is not simply a property of the Weinstein mechanism. This is inherent to gravitational collapse, and I will come back to an explanation for this.
The Weinstein, which you have included in the linear one, right? The one over three goes to zero and at high enrichment.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's all, that's implicit in the linear growth.
Where would you say is where the Weinstein mechanisms, on what scale is it start operating?
Well, you can just look at the difference between linearized and full, but that's, I can't say it any better than that. So you can basically say there's few percent effects already at hit of 0.1, and in the self-accelerating branch, which hasn't, where the Weinstein mechanism is even more important, you can see it going out to less than 0.1. So it depends on the model,
Is it obvious why the linear prediction turns down?
This is...
So it goes up?
So this is the first correction to first... For the leading correction due to five-dimensional effect, you have this term which goes like K1/KRC. Right. So in ordinary gravity, the first correction to the Newtonian gravity is 1/K² h squared order, and here you get a term that's linear in 1/K because of this non-local five-dimensional effects, and that's this term. Basically, gravity starts to leak into the fifth dimension.
So you go...
The red line, the dash peaks around...
No, the red line, the dash. The black dash.
Oh, this. Why, this turns around.
Linear prediction. So it's the...
The linear prediction is the... That's the line. It's perfectly... If it looks curved, then it's...
Which one are you worried about?
No,
Einstein
and the red.
It's linear,
not linear.
The gravity is linear.
that, not the growth.
Linearized the full, it's
yes, it's only the linearized DGP just means you don't linearize the DGP frame minimum equation.
But what if you just do linear power spectrum?
That's the dot. Yeah, it's okay. Scale dependent also.
So that would actually go up with respect to GR prediction?
Well, it's positive for the normal branch, yes. And it's scaled in memory.
I think I got a fifth force, basically.
There is a fifth force.
Right.
So
yeah.
The fifth force is not
and
seen here.
No, that is the fifth force.
Point two.
Yeah, so this is a linear enhancement as predicted by the character.
So then it goes down to zero.
Right.
Because of Einstein.
Okay.
Right, and what the nonlinear, even with or without Einstein, what the nonlinear power spectrum does on even smaller scales, I'm not going to speculate on that. Because I think it's completely not obvious what will happen.
So why does the error bar increase with the towards smaller scales?
Oh, this is just more and more a sample of variance that comes in. So 64 megaparsec box, you know, the density variation on the box scale is much larger than for the larger boxes. And
so
that's the same number of. So here I also have fewer boxes than here because.
Oh, so basically you have many simulations to calculate.
Yes, I combine many simulations. Yes, I should have said that. So this is. So these are four different box sizes from 400 megaparsecs down to 64 megaparsecs. And in each case, several simulations combined. Okay, so obviously we would like to understand where the shape comes from of the power spectrum. But we would also like to extend these predictions to different parameter sets, different omega m, different crossover scales, and because if we want to ever compare with data, we have to marginalize over many parameters. And obviously, we can't run 300-hour simulations for every single parameter point, so it's desirable to have some kind of model for these. And so very popular ansatz to look at nonlinear structure is the HALO model. So we basically say that all matter is today in collapsed, spiralized structures, dark matter halos. And for simplicity, you assume they're all spherical. And so then you can really characterize them in terms of their abundance, which is the halo mass function, the clustering, which led to halo bias, and the matter distribution within those halos, the density profile. And so you can calculate those two items by spherical collapse and so-called Kreschecker theory, practice we use Schaff-Thormann, and the halo density profiles are usually fit by NFW profile. Obviously, we don't have too much resolution to look at halo density profiles in these fixed grid simulations, but we can say some things. So let's look at the abundance of halos in simulations. This is, again, relative to the normal branch, relative to lambda CDM. And this is the halo mass in terms of M200, in terms of matter density. And you can see that at cluster scale mass, so the enhancement of halos grows sharply with, towards the high mass end, which is just what you expect because high mass halos are very rare. And assuming that all halos become a little bit more massive once you turn on the additional fifth force, that you know we'll see the highest enhancement at the high mass end, right? And so we've done a spherical collapse calculation in DGP, which is so interesting separate topic on its own, and try to encapsulate sort of the range that we would expect the Weinstein mechanism to act on spherical collapse, and that results in this shaded band. Okay, so the lower bound, the enhancement is what you expect with Weinstein mechanism, the upper if you didn't have any Weinstein mechanism. And you can see the spread is quite small, and indeed we don't see a large effect in the simulations of the Weinstein mechanism. There's some hint
at the high mass end, the full simulations have slightly fewer halos than the linearized simulations, but it's only a hint. So no clear sign of the Weinstein mechanism in the simulations, and our model basically would tell us that we don't expect that given the error bars.
We did a spherical collapse calculation taking into account the Weinstein mechanism using the spherically symmetric solution. And so that gives you a different overdensity threshold for collapse and also a different variable overdensity.
Yeah, but what does that mean, the spherical collapse, right?
Top hat, just the spherical top, sorry, yeah, spherical, so spherical top hat collapse. And it turns out in UGP, the perfect top hat stays a top hat. Only a top hat. In general, if you have a more general density profile that collapses in UGP, the Weinstein mechanism will make it change.
Yeah, exactly.
But the top hat, because it has a constant interior density, is unaffected by the. The Weinstein mechanism affects all shells.
Right. Like, you could probably do better, I guess, with a more realistic population with some sort of initial peak.
Right, yeah, but then, but then you would have, it's more work, but you could do it with this. This is just the very simplest thing you could do.
This is fine. It's also not hard, but okay.
And there's a separate issue with how you find the variable radius of these halos. So, separate topic, but we came up with a way to generalize the usual treatment of that. So these are the density profiles of halos. This is really pushing the resolution to the limits of the simulations, and even still, we can't really resolve the transition to the softer profile in NFLD. So you would imagine that it continues somehow like this, but we can't resolve it. In any case, what's interesting is that
you see effects at so this is basically the radius of the halo, the R200, and you can see that there are effects at a few R200 that, in the normal branch, you have enhanced density profile in the environment of halos and the self-accelerating is suppressed. But as you go in towards the cores of halos, there's hardly, given the errors, there's hardly a noticeable effect. So it seems that scale radius RS should be unchanged. And the idea is that the cores of dark matter halos, the innermost kiloparsecs, have formed quite early on. And early on, there was this, the effect of the brain bending mode is strongly suppressed due to this beta function being very large. So there's very little effect there was very little fifth force when these inner parts formed, and so they just remained inert up to today, and that's why the profiles are unmodified in the inner regions. That's the picture. It might be more complex than that.
But these halos?
Depends on the model, but from here to here. So in some sense, the innermost regions are always screened from the fifth force. But that doesn't mean, you still have info, right? That doesn't mean, it really depends on what the history of these cores is. If they did not experience any significant evolution since early times. So this region out here is basically where active infall is taking place onto the halo. And this regime, the Weinstein, this is a border of Weinstein radius, or maybe even larger, so the forces are not screened here yet, and enhanced infall takes place.
How much does R200 change for a given halo between lambda CDM?
Well, so basically you're asking how much more massive does a halo become?
Yeah.
That's a good question. I haven't tried cross-matching individual halos because at the high mass end, it's definitely possible. So I could try doing that. I haven't so far tried to, you know, map individual halos from GR simulations to DGP simulations, which is what you would have to do to identify how much an individual halo grows. So, and I assume there will be a large scatter, but there should be, I mean, you should be able to detect an average trend. Okay, right, so these are the basic, I skipped through a lot of details here, but basically once you know the abundance of halos, their clustering and their profiles,
you can build a model for the nonlinear power spectrum. It works this way. It basically breaks apart into a two-halo part where you're correlating two different halos, which is important on large scales, and then on small scales, smaller than a typical halo size, you get the one halo term contributing with 2 points within one halo. And so, I'm sorry, this is cut off again, but so the red lines show the two halo term, you know, it's proportional to, essentially proportional to the linear power spectrum. The green line shows the one halo term. And so the two halo term is really, as I said, dominated by the correlations between different halos, whereas the one halo term is completely determined by the halo profiles and the abundance of halos. You can see that generally, so this is the halo model. This is basically the halo model calculation that that I obtained the mass function from I showed earlier. You see that, of course, the two halo power spectrum is enhanced in DGP, so thick line versus thin line, again, normal branch. But the enhancement in the one halo term, especially on large scales, is much larger. And this is because on these scales, in the one halo term, these are fairly large scales, so only the largest halos contribute to this part of the one halo power spectrum. And those are the ones that are significantly more abundant in DGP than in lambda CDM. Similarly, exactly the same picture holds, I mean, very similar picture holds for FFR. And so if you add those two together, you get the halo model power spectrum, which is the blue lines. So if you compare the two blue lines, you can basically eyeball that essentially the linear enhancement on large scales, and then as you approach the nonlinear scales, the intermediate region, the one halo term starts to contribute, and the large difference in the one halo term drives the difference in the nonlinear power spectrum. Then as you go to smaller and smaller scales, where essentially you look more and more inside halos, the two converge again. And so this basically exactly gives you this turnover. If you take the ratio of the two, it exactly gives you this turnover we see in the simulations. So and the shaded regions show what we expect from our halo model calculations for DGP with and without the Weinstein mechanism. So the idea would be that the lower line here matches full DGP simulations, the blue, the upper line, the red, the linearized DGP simulations. Obviously, we have some mismatch here. It doesn't work perfectly well, but it's interesting to note that the width of the shaded band really does correspond quite closely to the separation between the linearized and DGP, full DGP simulations. Works even better in the self-accelerating branch here, from here. So basically, what would one possibility is to run a lot of simulations for linearized DGP, which are just as fast as GR, and which you can use to scan over parameter space, and then use such a halo model to map the linearized DGP power spectrum to the full DGP. For example, just one possible application. So how much time do I have? Oh, okay. Let me just briefly talk about, so power spectrum was a completely standard observable halo mass function as well, as Alexei talked about this morning. Let me come to something that's more like a specific modified gravity thing, which is comparison of dynamics versus lensing. So in general, scalar tensor theories affect the dynamics of non-relativistic particles very differently than lensing, which is basically exactly what you use in the solar system to constrain scalar tensor theories. Now, we can move those tests to cosmological scales. On large scales, you can compare redshift distortions with, for example, galaxy-galaxy lensing. And this has been originally proposed by Peng Jie in 2008, I think, and recently applied by Reyes et al. So they have actually measured that with LRGs. Very beautiful measurement. On small scales, where again, there might be more statistics available, you can compare the lensing mass to the dynamical mass of virialized objects. For example, typically galaxy clusters. So X-rays, SZ, and galaxy velocity is pretty much all dynamical measurements. You can compare those to the lensing mass. So I'm sorry, this is cut off again, but nothing dramatic happens over here. This plot shows the dynamical mass over lensing mass for the different DGP models that I simulated. The dots are simulation measurements. The shaded bands are analytical models. And you can see that in the self-accelerating branch, basically, your dynamical mass should be 2% smaller than 2% smaller than the lensing mass. And that's completely dominated by the Weinstein mechanism, because the linear prediction would be something like 30%. So 30% or between 20 and 30%. And you see that the Weinstein mechanism reduces this to 2%. So it somewhat depends on how effective your nonlinear mechanism is. But it could be a very interesting measurement.
Well, so this is average up to R200, and I mean it depends really on the average density.
How? So what radius?
Right. Yeah.
You go to smaller radii.
If you go to very small radii, then it becomes very small. Yes.
So, question: could you just remind us what's the difference between that -1 and -2?
Yeah. Sorry. So -2 has a larger crossover scale, so the RFC is 3,000 megaparsecs, so the modified gravity effects are smaller than this case, which has 500 megaparsecs. So, as I said, it's basically a free parameter in this in these normal branch models, because I adjust the dark energy to match minus EM, so it could be even larger than this, whatever you want. And at F of R, the picture is quite different, just for comparison. So you see, just focus on the blue points here. That's at a model with FR naught 10 to minus 5, currently completely allowed. And you see that there's a very strong mass dependence, which is due to the inherently chameleon mechanism. So at small masses, chameleon mechanism doesn't act, so less than several tenths of minus, like less than 10 to 14, chameleon mechanism doesn't act, and your dynamical mass will be 18% larger than lensing mass. And that is something that you can actually, I think you should be able to measure in the near future. Then as you go to higher and higher masses, the chameleon mechanism becomes more and more important, and eventually you go back to the GR value.
So what's the definition of dynamical mass and lensing mass scale? How did you measure that from simulations?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So dynamical mass, yeah, it's a sort of an idealized measurement. So it's basically if you would, it's basically measuring the mass-weighted velocity dispersion within the halo, and converting that to a mass. That's what you would get. And basically in the simulations, I have measured it exactly that way. Unfortunately, it's a very noisy measurement. So what I did here, I measured the potential well for a given halo in the modified gravity simulations, the potential well you would get in GR and the one you get in FR or DGP, and then just calculate from that potential well, assuming it's virialized, what velocity is working. So that in that way, you get reduce a lot of the scatter due to environment and so on.
Lensing mass is just a mass.
Yes, exactly. Yes, yes. And which is true for both FR and HP, at least in these parameters.
Fabian, just a comment. The dynamical mass from observations, if you measure it from stars or even galaxy that also dispersion, then the dynamical mass would actually be more or less equal to the lensing mass, just because it would be streamed.
Well, that's the key point here is that if you look at black holes, yes, or neutron stars.
No,
but if you look at something, a non-relativistic object, whose potential well will not be as deep as that of the halo of the host halos that I'm looking at here, then it will not be screened. If the host halo is not screened, then its constituents will not be screened.
If the host halo is not.
Basically, what counts is the depth of the potential well.
Yes.
So the potential well of a galaxy within a cluster is smaller than the overall potential well of the cluster. So the galaxy will only be screened if it's part of a screened larger halo.
Yes, I see. Whereas if you try to do the same thing, let's say, for an individual galaxy, let's say, I can compare the lensing mass versus the stellar, you know, dynamical mass from the stellar, let's say, stellar velocity dispersion.
Right.
In that case, I think it would be guaranteed to be fairly consistent because the stars would be screened. They are just like the sun, just like the sun.
Yeah. I think it's something to worry about. I agree.
I see what you're saying. In your situation, it's completely different.
Okay, so and this is also important if you constrain the cluster of abundance from X-ray clusters, for example, or a Z cluster, because those will typically measure some form of dynamical mass.
And in FFR in particular, you can get a significant enhancement of your mass function just by this effect. So in our constraints, which I now didn't talk about, we were conservative and assumed lensing mass, but actually we could have assumed a 20% higher mass for FFR. Okay, so to conclude, we all know that. I think I tried to show that understanding structure formation in nonlinear regime is important to both prove the viability of the models, show that these nonlinear mechanisms work in high density regions and to place constraints. I think Wayne flashed the result. I didn't mention it too much, but I can talk about it if anyone asks. I hope we're starting to open the door to probing gravity on megaparsec scales. Thank you.
Questions? That is on the Let's thank Gabian again and everybody who spoke today.